Accession number 27804, Squadron Leader Ian Blair, Reel 12. Now, we're coming now to when Italy joins the war, which is, we think it's the 12th of June. We don't know.
Yeah, but, it was either the 12th or 14th of June, but I haven't got it noted here specifically. But the point was, the squadron at Heliopolis had just returned from Aden about a week before with our Mark 1 Blenheims. We called them clapped out Mark 1, but they were really thrashed. But we had a week titivating and cleaning, and then suddenly we are deployed to Mersa True. Just like that, on a war footing.
Now, is that going to be your base? Was that your base for a while?
No, tell a lie. It wasn't Mersmer True. It was Martin Bagush, sorry. Yeah, that was going to be our operation. The forward base up in the desert, 100 miles
it's
east.
Martin where? How do you spell that? Just to make sure we get this right.
M-A-A-T-H-A-N, capital B-A-G-U-I-S-H. It's 100 miles west of Alexandria. It was a desert airfield, desert landing strip. It was also the group headquarters of 202 Group, where our friend, Air Commodore in charge, Raymond Collishaw, had his dugout. It was it was down about 10 feet, pucker dugout, wartime thing. But the point was that the squadron, with this brief notice, moved to the desert on the day war was declared, 12th, because no, it couldn't have been the 13th. I don't think so. 13th with a rung a bell. It was the 12th, it doesn't matter. 12th or 13th. But we moved up to the desert that day, that morning, and war was declared, I believe, about midday. When we arrived in the desert, for some reason or other, an advance party had got up there. I don't know how they arrived, but they had pitched our tents. And but what we didn't know when we got there, we didn't know where the bomb dump was. We didn't know where the refueling facilities were. We didn't know where the ammunition was. So as an armourer, I mustered my guys, and we went in search of the bits and pieces. So we had to prepare the bombs for the bombing raid, which were 250-pound bombs. So I left all my guys sorting that out. The refueling was done by the fitters and the riggers. Incidentally, in these days, we didn't have a bowser. I don't know if people realise this, but the fuel was tipped into a large bucket used for toilets, big bucket. It was clean, of course, tipped into that, and then it was hand pumped through with a hand pump up to the main plane, which is probably about 15 or 20 feet high above the head, and poured into the tanks through a funnel, an 8 or 12 inch funnel with a chamois leather on it to filter it. That's how the refueling was done. Took ages. Tiring as well, because constantly pouring.
Now, what was this base at Matan Bagush like? Can you just
what was it like? It was a piece of desert.
So it's a desert airstrip?
It wasn't a strip. It was just a piece of desert. No strip. A piece of desert with a road running down the northern edge, which was the main road to Mersa True and All Points West. And then on one side of the road was a few huts, which included the sergeant's mess, believe it or not, and on the other side of the road was the AOC's dugout, which was dug in the ground with a roof on it, and a few tents, and the flight dispersal, which likewise were a few tents, and we had aircraft dispersed around the if I can show you.
They can't see it, remember?
No, you can't read it. But that was Mersa True Airfield, which is 50 miles further west. That's the road that ran to Saloum and All Points West that runs right along that picture. You can see the name Mersa True on the ground. But that was 50 miles further up. But that was just all it was. And round the perimeter track, we had a few telegraph poles and a couple of 3 miles away, we had a high escarpment which, you know, part with a quite high, was another landing strip up on that, up on the escarpment. But however, we got there and we mustered all the services that we needed, the weapons, the ammunition. We had to sit down and all the armourers, once they fused the bombs, they helped the air gunners to load the magazines, because there was no tracer ammunition. We had to load it by ball. It was all ball ammunition, and the magazines were on the Vickers gun. This is were 60 round magazines, very thin, about an inch thick, and they were wound up by a clockwork spring. And if you didn't have the tools loading, which was like a handle which you turned, which engaged and wound the spring up, you had to do that by hand. And you'll find that many an armourer missed the handle and always got himself cut down the left thumb, split the thumb down from A to B. Well, that was a bit unfortunate, but that's what we had to do. We had to load all these. Now, I didn't know which aircraft I was going to be flying in, although I knew I was going to be flying. By this time, which was May, no,
June.
It was the beginning of June. I'd just been made up to an acting sergeant unpaid on the 29th of May, which is just a fortnight before the war. I only found that out from my records.
As an acting
sergeant unpaid, stress the unpaid bit, corporal armourer / air gunner. That was the full designation. I can't remember what pay I was getting, but I know that I was getting a penny a day more than a full sergeant air gunner who had the rank. I don't know. I had to pay all the mess subs as well. It was a bit naughty. However, to cut the long story short, we were told the squadron was to be briefed at 0600 hours in the morning for a takeoff at 8 or something like that.
And this would be the first raid of the war.
This was the going to be. Now, we all turned up in the briefing tent, me included, my skipper and my air gunner. And I was, in this case, I was nominated to fly as an air gunner. Didn't worry me. I was flying with somebody different to start with. So the briefing went ahead, and something like this: the squadron will take off at 6 o'clock, and they'll fly out, and we'll do a low-level attack on Al Adam Airfield, which is across the border, near south of Tobruk, about 50 or 20 miles south of Tobruk. When they get to the target area, they were let down in long line astern, and we were number 8, and there was one aircraft behind us. Long line astern, and do two passes across the target, drop bombs on the one way, and drop them on the right, and scarper.
Now, do you know the date this was going to be on?
This was on the day after the war was declared.
So you think the 13th?
First raid of the war, it was. This was contribution by two groups, squadrons. I can't remember them in the history. I could turn it up for you.
202 group, is that the group?
I think it was 202 group, yeah.
Now, so that's your briefing. Now, what about this question? You weren't going to fly with Tommy Knott.
Yeah, no, it was coming out. When the battle order was exposed on the blackboard, all the crews had been mixed up. When I say mixed up, there was people flying with people who normally they didn't fly with. And when I looked down for my skipper, I found that I wasn't flying with him, and he was flying with had some other guy. And so I said to my skipper, look, this is a bit silly, really, when you come to think about it. We've been training as a crew for nearly 3 years, and now they're going to split us up when they want us. And he said, yeah, that's right. So being the type he was, he said, put his hand up, and he made his point, because it affected everybody. And sure enough, a quick reappraisal, and all the crews reverted to norm. So but I didn't have a... I was relegated to the air gunner. It worried me. But anyway, and I can't remember what the navigator's name was, but I knew him. He was quite good. And So there we were, and of course, unfortunately, the takeoff was delayed. It didn't get off at six as we were supposed to do. We weren't really.
Now,
we
what didn't. Preparations did you have to do to get ready to fly?
Well, we had first of all, we had to bomb all the aircraft up and arm them. That was, I mean, that was the airplanes. Once they were serviceable, but there was always hiccups because of the delays in locating and refueling and all the other nonsense. But we had this reappraisal at the briefing. And then the thing that I really remember about was this intelligence officer got up and he said, we're expecting opposition from the Italian Air Force in the form of CR-32s and 42s. That was a biplane fighter, not dissimilar to the Gladiator, but the same performance. He said, they're armed with 50 caliber inch guns. And he said they haven't got a long endurance, 55 minutes. And the important thing, he says, that if a stern attack develops, the metal skin of the Blenheim will deflect the shots, grow greener than the proverbial cabbage we were. However, and that was a statement, and we went away.
And you believed it?
We believed it. I suppose we did believe it. So we went to our aircraft, and it was hot, quite hot by this time. Anyway, we were perspiring like nobody's
business. Now, what was your flying kit then? Because flying kit does change during the war. What would you be wearing then?
Well, I wore a dark blue overall on top of my... It's in that photograph up there, actually. That's that dark blue overall. Tommy Knott gave me that. Sometime during our term of service, I think he got himself a white one actually, but he gave me that, and I wore that on top of my.
And that's just overalls.
It's just an overall. I wore a scarf, of course, and you had your uniform underneath. But the thing was,
but no sidcot or anything like that.
No, he was perspiring like a pig, and the aircraft was hot to touch, and you got in and you got into this oven, and you. You know, everything, you perspired like nobody's business. And then when you got up off the ground, you froze and you're on sweat. I mean, that's a fact of life. But that's the way I operated with a Mae West, of course.
Is that picture taken from this time? Because we're going to discuss...
That was taken on the 4th of September, 1940.
So that's taken before that's relative, then?
Pardon?
That's taken before this raid.
Oh, yes.
Hang on, 4th of September, 1940 or 1939?
No, 40.
Okay, so it's not been taken yet.
They've already been battling on for about four months
we'll
by that time.
But it's got a
history. The
this is the famous photograph. We'll be referring to it later.
That's fine.
Right, so you got your fire kit, you're sweating like pigs, and
you get into the aircraft. Now, as an armourer, I had managed to get 100-round magazines, as opposed to 60-round. 100-round magazine is about 2 inches thick in turn, but it had carried for the Vickers gas operated gun. The gun fired very quickly, so the original magazines were 60 rounds, which you know, fire one burst and it's finished. So I got these 100, and I used to have them. I used to carry these separately in a box in the in the bottom of the turret, stick them on the pegs nearest to so I was reasonably confident. Plus the fact I had my stoppage clearing tools in my pocket, which I normally carried, and a screwdriver and the usual things that armourers carry. So eventually off we went, and lovely day. It was clear, cloudless day. I felt a bit twitchy, I suppose, as
That's
a probably operating.
How nervous? I mean, you know.
I think I had a gut ache, which I think was... not uncommon. A tightening of the muscles of the stomach. I felt confident because I'm my own ability to shoot and hit things, and I wasn't worried about that. And I was in the turret, which was fine. I could cope with the turret.
Now, can you describe the turret? What was the turret like? What did you have about you? How did it work?
Well, it was a Bristol turret. It was a hydraulic turret, and Gunner sits on a little seat with a hand, he has little handlebars about this big, about 8 inches wide, 12 inches wide, and the gun triggers in there. And you, by moving this, moving it up, you elevated and depressed the gun went down
by,
and the seat came
by
up.
By twisting, but, like, yeah. Like in a motorcycle.
Yeah, it's just exactly. And likewise, when you turned it right or left, the turret turned right or left. The unfortunate thing about the turret was it used to have a cutout device so that when you depressed the turret, when you depress the turret, there's a picture at the bottom there, just depress the turret, there's a cutout device on the top of the, there's a cutout, I think that's it there, a little thing there. It bears on the, a cam on the top of the fuselage, so it cuts out, it stops the guns firing.
So you can't shoot your own aircraft?
That's that? Correct, that's the purpose. But the single gunner these days, magazine fed, it was held on by two quick release pins, which were about an inch and a half long. I don't know if you know what a quick release pin. It has a knurled knob on it, and when you turn the knob, it retracts a little hook, and you pull the pin out. So when you put the pin in, you turn it, and it's locked in. And that little back plate as the chin rest for the gunner, so you had this chin up against this and the hands on the grip, and the turret would rotate fairly, it could turn it right round to about 90 degrees beam. And
how much practice have you had in this? I mean, because you'd mainly been a navigator.
Yeah, but that, you do a daily inspection on turrets, and I had fired it occasionally. I'd done Lewis guns on the back of a Heinz. I didn't have a lot of practice. I couldn't write my name with using the turret or anything like that, but I knew what it was about. I knew how it worked, and I knew how.
So you were confident.
Yeah, I didn't. It was almost second nature. If that's probably.
Now, what was the takeoff like? I mean, how did you take off? Did you take off as a squadron or one by one?
No, we took off almost in line abreast, because you did that because of the sand. The object was to keep the sand away from you, so you could see where you were going.
So if you all went together.
Yeah, it went on a stream, fairly, you know, echelon, staggered. And off we went and got up and set course. It was probably an hour and three quarters. It was quite a long trip, actually. But I wore dark glasses, and I was constantly, cloudless, of course, constantly looking upwards and looking up in the I knew the score. I knew what was going to happen. I had a feeling I was looking for the opposition. And I was a gun cocked, everything at the ready. And
were you quartering this? Did you look in a certain way, or just look out of the sun, or out of...
I constantly look into the sun. You have to keep looking. You had to look all the way. But the sun was the obvious direction from which, theoretically, attack should come. However, as we got up towards, you sort of crossed the frontier. We'd done so many hours over the desert, as I said, you could almost pick out the thorn bushes and navigate by that. But we got over the border, and then they started letting down. Now, with the turret on the beam, you could look forward, see your own aircraft, the aircraft in front, and all the other seven aircraft in front of that. So we're gradually, I'll never forget this, gradually spreading out. And we were number eight. There was one guy behind us. And it gradually got lower and lower and lower. And then when I could see in the distance, I could see the airfield, target airfield. So what happened? We were getting on, I was watching for these hostile aircraft. Anyway, we got very low, because we had long delay fuses in the bombs, low, and we rushed across the perimeter of the airfield near the hangars, and I had a quick burst at the opposition on the ground as it went along. There was a group of a group of Italian soldiers standing in a crescent shape with rifles. I remember them. And next to that, there was a long line of Breeder 65 aircraft all running up. So I started firing as I went down the line. Don't know whether I hit anything, but I started firing anyway. And so by the time I got to change the magazine at the other end, an aircraft came up and turned round through 180 degrees. And as they turned round, there they were, all up there, all these Italian fighters in perfect formation.
Now, had you been dropping bombs?
Well, we dropped the bombs.
As you went in the first pass?
Two runs. We had dropped the first two on the way across, turned round and dropped two more on the way back.
And but then, when did you... It was at the end of the second pass then you sighted the Italian fighters, or the first pass?
No, the first pass, when he turned round. When he turned through 180 degrees, they were then down sun of me. I could see them, all glinting up there. It must have been about 12,000 feet there. And that's where it all started, literally. So we had to turn the aircraft around. The guy behind me was hit by the rifle fire on the ground, and he had to force land in the desert. Pasha Beauclair, I'll never forget him. He was mad as a hatter. Anyway, he was taken POW. I don't know how long he stayed a POW. A nice guy, actually, for what he was, but he was really round the bend. But anyway, he was lost. That made us the end aircraft. That wasn't very fair. I wasn't very happy about that. But anyway, these aircraft...
Now, what formation were you flying in?
We're loose formation, on the deck.
Low down?
Very low. In fact, we got so low we were creating dust storms.
So what happened? You sight the aircraft, what happened?
Yeah, they started to peel off and do their attack. And they obviously picked the guy who was flying level with us on the deck on the far side. We were beetling off for home. We weren't loitering in any way. But we just kept on just watching this guy and come down. And he came down a nice quarter attack, and I tracked him down and opened fire. And he was miles away, but I opened fire on this guy. And with no trace, actually. You couldn't sit, open fire, and he broke off. Oh, I felt great. Then we pressed on, and another aircraft come down. Only this guy knew what he was about. And he closed, I'm not kidding you, he closed right in. He was firing. I could see his guns on the... He was about 30 yards away, sitting off the tail in the blind spot. He knew jolly well. I could see this guy. And I was saying to my skipper, turn port and turn starboard. And he was on the deck, really low, creating this dust at the back. And this guy, this guy must have been, I say, 20 or 30 yards away. CR 32 it was. Inline engine, I think it was. And I had the quick release pins out. I had one out. And I was just about to, because by pulling them out, you get another 10 degrees depression. And I thought to myself, I'm going to have this guy. I mean, he was very lethal from where he was. He was firing. His deflection couldn't have been very good, but he was firing. And I was going to have a blast at this. But just as I was about to fire, I might have shot a bit of my tail off, but that was a risk I had to take, I suppose. Anyway, the guy broke off. And the guy, my opposite number on the other, all his gun was stuck up in the air, you see. Not giving us any cross support or anything. I was furious with this guy. He was a wireless operator. Didn't have the experience to start us. But anyway, we got down on the deck and we got back. And
so these Italians didn't attack for long, then they broke off.
Well, they didn't have the endurance, you see. I mean, we were going flat out, don't forget. And they had only 55 minutes endurance, and they'd already been up there. They got up to 12,000 feet before. They probably followed us for about 10 minutes, which was... I fired, and my cockpit was covered in row. I was firing right, left, and center. I fired an awful lot of ammunition, but I didn't think it hit anyway. But psychologically, it was... So when I got back on the base, one aircraft short, of course. And it was then when I got out and slid down the wing and looked underneath, I could hear this gunfire. Well, the tack, tack, tack that I could hear, I thought was the bullet striking the underside of the underside of the aircraft. In actual fact, it must have been the 50 caliber guns that was so close I could hear. But the skipper heard it, and he got out and he slid off the wing and he looked under, and he said, if that's air fighting, we've had it. And these were his actual words. Unfortunately, it came to pass. He was shot down subsequently. But
now, what was wrong with the Blenheim? Then, just sum it up. I mean, why were you doomed?
It wasn't fast enough. That was simple. Beautiful, lovely aircraft, ideal for the job, but it wasn't any good against opposition, and that was only the Italians. I mean, we didn't have at that time. We didn't have the 109s. The 109s were playing merry havoc with them back in UK. We knew that because they were 100 miles an hour faster than the Blenheim. Hopelessly.
So speed. Anything else wrong with it that was obvious? Or was it mainly
just speed? I mean, if you didn't have the speed, you were hiding to nothing. Later on, it became even worse for the simple reason they took the bomb doors off to fit what we call small bomb containers. I don't know if you've ever seen a small bomb container, but it's a long 6 foot rectangular, 6 foot long aluminium cylinder which is about a foot in cross section, and into that there are two compartments into which you put 20-pound fragmentation bombs and 40-pound fragmentation, four 20-pounders and three 40-pounders, and you put them into this long open cylinder of the device, and you have a bar across the center of gravity which is pivoted and connected to the bomb release mechanism. So when you press the button, it releases one end and it drops free and the bombs follow. It was used for fragmentation, anti-personnel and
And that made him slower still.
Took 30 miles an hour off the speed. And we carried four of these and lost all that speed, which didn't improve the performance one iota.
Now, what happened when you got back to your thing? You've had this chat with Tommy, no? He said, you know...
Well, we had a debrief, a usual briefing.
What was the debriefing like? What would happen at a debriefing?
Well, the usual thing. What did you see and what did you shoot at and the usual thing. I said by piece, I'd fired at this guy and so on and so forth. And not a lot, but the important thing was that we got back. We were, I suppose, relieved about that. But this low-level nonsense wasn't conducive to...
The whole raid had been a low-level raid.
Oh, yes. We were only one of many aeroplanes. Our squadron, I think there was about... We only had about three squadrons, you know. We didn't have a great deal of numbers of squadrons at that time in the Middle East. I think the maximum number we could muster was 27 at any one time. I seem to remember the statistics saying. But... and we didn't have any fighter cover, which was sadly lacking.